You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. I'm a health editor here at NPR, and I've got four stories for you today. The first is on toxic pets. It's about the chemicals your pets are being exposed to around the house and the possible health effects. The second is about putting your medical records online and what's involved with that. The third is about the health reform proposals of presidential candidate John McCain. And finally, we'll take a look at how Japan provides health care to all its citizens. Now, this first story got quite a bit of attention around the office the other day. We were sitting around the lunch table, and John Hamilton started talking about a study he was looking at showing that pets are being exposed to some toxic chemicals found in carpets and couches. These are chemicals that humans are also being exposed to, but the pet exposure was quite a bit higher. Here is his report.
If you just walk on a stain-resistant carpet, you may get a tiny, tiny dose of chemicals called PFCs. But what if you stretched out on that carpet for a while and then licked your fur? Richard Wiles and his colleagues at the Environmental Working Group wanted to know.
It occurred to us that no one had actually tested pets who live in the same environment as we do for the toxic contaminants that we know are in people.
The group took samples from several dozen healthy dogs and cats at a clinic in Virginia. That's a pretty small sample. Still, Wiles says lab tests revealed some interesting stuff.
Teflon chemicals, stain-resistant coatings that you'd find in your carpet, flame retardants that you might find in your furniture, mercury that might be in, say, cat food.
Levels of some chemicals were lower in pets than in people. But dogs had more than twice the level of stain-fighting chemicals called PFCs. In cats, mercury levels were five times what's usually found in people, and levels of flame retardants called PBDEs were 23 times higher. Wiles says the findings suggest that pets could serve as a warning system for people.
It's the canary in the coal mine, if you will. They're picking up the same chemicals that we're exposed to. They have shorter lifespans, and they develop diseases more quickly. And so they may be providing some insight into human health problems from these same contaminants in our homes.
But only if the chemicals are making pets sick. So far, there's not much evidence. One exception is a study done by Larry Glickman of Purdue University. He was trying to explain an epidemic of thyroid disease in cats.
We were able to show that cats that had clinical signs of hyperthyroidism had significantly higher intake of canned cat foods.
Glickman suspects the culprit is a chemical called bisphenol A, used to line the cans. But to know for sure, scientists would have to deliberately expose cats to the chemical.
While I'm not a proponent of experimenting on dogs and cats, sometimes very small experimental studies can tell us a whole lot more and answer questions that you just cannot do by studying cats or dogs in homes.
The Environmental Working Group hopes that better studies of pets will bring stronger regulations to protect people. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Well, that was really interesting. So I asked John if he could stop by and talk some more about it. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So the first question I think some people might have after hearing that is, especially if they own pets, is my pet at risk from rolling around and getting all these chemicals in their system?
Well, at least the pets in this study were all healthy, even the ones who seem to have relatively high levels of some of these chemicals. So we're not saying that just because your pet has some of these chemicals that there's necessarily any kind of health problem attached. However, there are a few studies that suggest that high levels of these chemicals may be related to some problems like thyroid disease in cats.
These chemicals are found in people, too, I understand. I mean, has it ever been shown that they're harmful in people?
No. The word is still out on what these chemicals do to people. Naturally, some of the things found, like mercury, yes, it has been shown that if you get too much mercury in you, it's bad for brain development. But most of the chemicals, the problem is we don't know exactly what they are doing to people. We don't know what safe levels are. And the reason this whole study came about was because the Environmental Working Group has done a series of studies where they looked at what chemicals, what industrial-type chemicals are found in people, and they wanted to know whether they were in pets as well. So they did this study, and sure enough, a lot of the things that are in us are also in our pets.
One of the questions that came up at lunch was, well, why don't we just get rid of all these chemicals? I mean, why do we need them in our furniture and in our carpet?
Well, if you're talking about chemicals that prevent stains on carpet, say, it's convenient, but obviously, you know, we're going to do okay without that. On the other hand, when you're talking about something like fire retardant chemicals, you know, before fire retardant chemicals were put into foam padding and that sort of thing, there were a lot of fires in houses and a lot of people died because things burned up in a way that they don't anymore. So before you want to talk about getting rid of those things, you certainly would want to have a safer alternative available.
Well, that's NPR's John Hamilton. Thanks for stopping by.
No problem.
If you find yourself going from doctor's office to doctor's office, you'll also find yourself filling out the same form over and over. Wouldn't it be nice just to have one single personalized medical record online that all doctors could access, and even more importantly, that the emergency room could access if you wind up there? A lot of companies are getting into the personalized medical records business, so we asked NPR's Joanne Silberner to check them out.
Debbie Witchie is like many Americans. She wants to have all her medical records accessible over the Internet. There are dozens of Internet sites that offer the service for free or for a monthly fee. Last year, she checked out promotional materials from one of the biggest ones, Revolution Health.
I was just about to switch doctors, and one of the things they talked about was how great it was to be able to keep all your records in one place, and I was having to go through the process of getting all my records and moving them around, and I thought, well, this would be a good opportunity to give it a try, so I signed up.
By filling out a few forms, she was able to get her old records scanned and uploaded onto the site, where she could print them out and bring them to her new doctor. The doctor reviewed the records and put them into Witchie's file. Then, during the physical exam, the doctor noticed Witchie's blood pressure was high and recommended medication. Witchie wanted to try diet first. The doctor said okay, as long as Witchie monitored herself closely. Witchie realized she could do that easily on the web.
I tracked my weight and my blood pressure on the Revolution Health site, and then I printed it out and took it to her every month.
Witchie demonstrates the process on her office computer.
I just go into Internet here. And then I sign in.
A few clicks and she's on her own page, where she can get background on blood pressure, and it's easy to call up her own record. She weighed herself and took her blood pressure every day. Entering the information took less than a minute. The fact that she was paying such close attention helped her a lot. She lost 50 pounds. And her blood pressure?
At the beginning, I don't remember. It was somewhere around 135 over 105. And now, the last time I took it, it was 107 over 71.
She has to input everything she wants in there, prescriptions, vaccinations, details of hospitalizations, because her doctor isn't connected to the system. And that's one of the drawbacks of personal health records, says medical records expert Joy Pritz of Georgetown University.
The problem now is getting that information from your family physician, for example. They're small practices, and most of them don't have their health information in electronic form.
So they can't send it to a website. That could change as big companies get involved. Right now, Microsoft and Google are in various stages of developing online medical record systems. Some major employers, including Intel and Walmart, are piloting programs as well. Some health insurers already let you have access to some information from your doctors. At the moment, creating and maintaining a full health record may be a job for the compulsive, Witchie says.
When I first sat down to sign up and get started, I had this vision that I was going to put all my information in here in one sitting and I'd be all set and ready to go. And it quickly became clear to me there's a lot more time to invest in it than I had originally thought about.
She hasn't put in her records from before 2003, for example. It's too early in the history of medical records for success stories or horror stories to have accumulated. One thing medical records experts are worried about is privacy. Joy Pritz of Georgetown University says if you're thinking about signing up for a personal health record, be careful.
Whether it's on the internet or it's offered through your employer or your health plan, you should try to really locate the part that tells who they can share your health information with.
Pritz says it may mean squinting a tiny type, but search for companies that pledge not to sell your information, trade it, or share it. Hope that no one subpoenas your records, and hope the company doesn't go under or get sold. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
We've been hearing a lot about the health reform plans of the Democrats in this year's presidential primaries, but what about the presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain? NPR's Julie Robner takes a closer look at his plan.
For the Democrats, the major focus and the disagreements have come over how to cover the 47 million Americans who currently have no health insurance. For Senator John McCain, however, that's a secondary issue.
The problem is not that most Americans lack adequate health insurance. The vast majority of Americans have private insurance, and our government spends billions each year to provide even more. The biggest problem with American health care system is that it costs too much.
The thrust of McCain's plan is to encourage people to buy their own insurance rather than get it through their jobs. He'd do that using several different strategies, giving people tax credits, encouraging more people to set up tax-advantaged health savings accounts, and letting them buy insurance policies across state lines. None of those ideas are new, but together, said McCain at a forum on health care last fall, they can help harness the purchasing power of individual consumers.
When it's their money and it's their decision, I think they make much wiser decisions than when it's provided by somebody else.
McCain also wants to rein in the government's big health care programs, Medicare and Medicaid. Just this week in Pittsburgh, for example, he criticized Medicare's new drug benefit for being too generous.
People like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, don't need their prescriptions underwritten by taxpayers. Those who can afford to buy their own prescription drugs should be expected to do so.
And one thing McCain says he won't do is impose any sort of requirement that people have health insurance, the sort of mandate that Clinton and Obama are currently sparring over.
I think that every American should have available and affordable college education, but I'm not going to mandate that every American go to college. I feel the same way about health care. If it's affordable and available, then it seems to me that, again, it's a matter of choice amongst Americans.
But there are a lot of questions about whether McCain's plan actually would make health insurance more affordable and more available.
John McCain and I have something in common. Neither one of us would be covered by his health care policy.
That's Elizabeth Edwards, wife of former Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards. Because McCain's plan doesn't require insurance companies to accept people with pre-existing health conditions, they could be turned down or have their condition excluded from coverage. Both McCain and Mrs. Edwards are cancer survivors.
The truth is, a health care policy that covers everything but cancer doesn't exactly do me a lot of good.
Bob Leshefsky, a health care consultant, says McCain's plan not only doesn't address how people who've been sick would get insurance, but he also hasn't answered the question of how older people will be able to afford coverage.
If you're older, you're going to pay a lot more than younger because individual health insurance is age rated. So he hasn't talked about what he's going to do with older people paying a lot more than younger people and how he's going to make health insurance affordable both for people who are sick and who are older and how he's just plain going to make it available for people who wouldn't pass medical underwriting now.
And Leshefsky says that for all of McCain's emphasis on holding down costs, he's not convinced the senator's plan would do that either. Many of McCain's cost-cutting proposals, things like putting more emphasis on prevention and electronic medical records, are the same as those in the Democrats' plans. And as for making patients more financially responsible?
Providers, insurance companies, employers have all failed at that. And now the big question is, why is the consumer going to be any more successful at doing that than the people who do this for a living?
Still, one thing McCain's health plan will do is give voters a clear choice from the plan that will be offered by whichever Democrat wins the nomination. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Over the next couple of months, NPR is going to look at the health systems in other countries to see how they provide health care to everyone. We got an early start on the series this week with a report on universal health care in Japan. Reporter T.R. Reid prepared the story for us. It was drawn from a larger documentary he did this week on Frontline on PBS called Sick Around the World.
Japan produces cars, computers, and color TVs, but it also produces the world's healthiest people. It has the longest healthy life expectancy on Earth. That's partly due to diet and lifestyle, but the universal healthcare system here plays a key role too. Everyone in Japan is required to get a health insurance policy, either at work or through a community-based insurer. The government picks up the tab for those who are too poor. That's a model of social insurance that's used in many wealthy countries, but it's definitely not socialized medicine. 80% of Japan's hospitals are privately owned, more than in the U.S., and almost every doctor's office is a private business. Dr. Kono Hitosh is a typical doctor. He runs a private 19-bed hospital in the Tokyo neighborhood of Soshigaya.
Well, the best thing about the Japanese medical system is that all citizens are covered, anyone, anywhere, anytime, and it's cheap.
Do they have to make an appointment to come?
No.
Never.
Never.
The Japanese go to the doctor about three times as often as Americans, and since there are no gatekeepers, they can see any specialist they want. Japanese patients stay in the hospital much longer than Americans on average. They love technology like scans. They have nearly twice as many MRIs per capita as Americans do. Professor Ikegami Naoki is Japan's top health economist.
In Denver, where I live, if you get an MRI of your neck region, it's $1,200. And the doctor we visited in Japan says he gets $98 for an MRI. So how do you do that?
Well, in 2002, the government said that the MRIs we are paying too much. So in order to be within the total budget, we will cut them by 35%.
So that's how they keep costs so low. The Japanese health ministry tightly controls the price of health care down to the smallest detail. Every 2 years, the doctors and the health ministry negotiate a fixed price for every procedure and every drug. That helps keep premiums to around $280 a month for the average Japanese family, and the employer picks up at least half of that, a lot less than Americans pay. And if you lose your job, you keep your health insurance. Japanese insurance plans are a lot more accommodating than American insurers. For one thing, they can't deny a claim, and they have to cover everybody. I asked Professor Ikegami if the insurers could turn down an applicant who had heart disease.
That is forbidden.
These health care plans covering basic health care for a worker and his family, do they make a profit?
No, because they are not allowed to make a profit, and anything left over is carried over to the next year. And if there's a lot carried over, then the premium rate would go down.
All right. Here's a country with fantastic health statistics, user-friendly insurance companies, no waiting lists, and rock-bottom cost. So who's complaining? Well, the doctors are. Dr. Kono says he's getting paid peanuts for all his hard work.
The treatment fee for a wound, anything under 100 square centimeters, that's 450 yen. The treatment fees are all listed here.
If somebody comes on the cut that's less than 6 square inches, so fairly small cut, he gets $4.30 to sew that up. Seems incredibly cheap.
It's extremely cheap.
Dr. Kono is forced to go outside the price book looking for ways to make a yen. He has 4 vending machines in his waiting room. And in a part of Tokyo with free street parking, he charges $4 an hour to park at his clinic. The upside is that virtually no one in Japan goes broke because of medical expenses. Professor Saito Hiredo is president of the Nagoya Central Hospital.
In Japan, how many people go bankrupt for medical costs?
I don't know.
Just the question seemed bizarre to him. He checked to make sure he'd understood me correctly. While the patients may be healthy, the hospitals are in even worse shape financially than the doctors.
I think our system is pretty good, pretty good. But no system is perfect.
Yes.
But now 50% of hospitals are in financial deficit now. So I'm afraid hospitals may be one of the endangered species in Japan now.
So here's the weak spot. While the U.S. probably spends too much on health care, the Japanese may be spending too little. In a country with $10 per night hospital stays, the prices are just not high enough to balance the books. Hospital prices too low? There's a problem a lot of countries wish they had. For NPR News, I'm T.R. Reid.
For more health coverage, you can tune into your local NPR station. You can find a list of them at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more health stories by clicking on Health and Science. It's over on the left side of the page. Joe Neal, NPR News.